In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Okay, here we are, episode 24. It's the best time of the week again. Time to find out what's going down in the enterprise tech world with what I think is some of the best people in the industry. I'm talking about Hans Delinier, Gabriel Chapman, and Mark Farley. How is everybody?
Hey now!
Hey!
Okay, so as we always do, let's go on and tie up some of the loose ends from last week's show. Over on our LinkedIn group, a listener, Jeff Wilson, was none too happy with some of the coverage that we gave Windows and Microsoft when it came to hyperconverged infrastructure last week. So if you guys don't mind, I'm going to take just a quick backseat here because I'm not really a believer in hyperconverged, at least not like some of you guys are. So somebody want to give us a quick rundown on what Jeff's gripes were and maybe what our response to Jeff is. And by the way, Jeff, thanks for getting involved and thanks for listening to the show. Totally appreciate what you're saying, but here's our retort.
Yeah, so what Jeff said in his comment, and he particularly didn't like something I said, you know, that I made some comment that Microsoft's not a player in this space, and I can't remember what I said. It was probably stronger than that, as sometimes we do on this show, but he took umbrage with that, and he said, well, look, of course, Microsoft Server is one of the most hyper-converged products out there. How can you not say that? You know, how can you not, you know, and he's got a point, except, and our point is it's not really a complete solution. And people should look at the thread. He's got a blog. I'm trying to remember what the name of his blog was. Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes. It's a good blog. And so anyway, Hans commented there, I commented there, and then there was a LinkedIn discussion also. But his point was that, you know, how could you guys be criticizing Microsoft for not being hyper-converged when Windows Server is a hyper-converged product? That was his point.
But so is Red Hat, so is SUSE, so is anybody else who has an operating system that can run a virtualized workload. And that just devalues the whole hyper-converged value prop.
Exactly.
It's more than just running storage on your server and having the ability to distribute it at some point.
Yeah, but to his point is that Microsoft Server is a particularly feature-rich product that has lots and lots of features that can be used.
The biggest value in a hyperconverged solution has nothing to do with the technology as such, but it is the way it is delivered, as in, I buy a node, and it's a single SKU, it's a single installation. All the components are in there in Windows Server. They may be even stronger than competitive products. I don't even know. But there is no simple way to have with like 1, 2, 3 clicks in 30 minutes a running cluster with all the management you need from a Windows platform. It's just not there. Maybe the Nutanix solution comes close, but that's what we said in the show last week. Other than Nutanix and GridStore, no one is doing it plain vanilla with Windows Server. And Windows at Microsoft is not pushing that.
No, there's no money in it for them. I mean, I think, you know, if Microsoft, like I said, if Microsoft wanted to get involved in the hyperconverged space, it would probably be a fairly simple lift for them to do so. They're more focused on Azure and their private cloud, public cloud offerings and everything else that they have going. And for them, a hyperconverged is an afterthought. And, you know, I think if you look at the, you know, what's Hyper-V's market share? 12% of the market in virtualization? I mean,
well, I think it's higher than that.
It's good. It's towards the 20s.
But Mark did say last week as well, they're giving that away, right? And I don't want to quote you there, Mark. But the idea is, right, they've got small market share in Hyper-V, and they're not charging the same as maybe what VMware are. So that's maybe a little bit distorted as well. If they were charging the same that VMware are, how much smaller might that market segment, not segment, but market share be? Here's a question. Can you be hyper-converged if you don't play in the hardware space? If you don't, because I think I'm agreeing with maybe what Hans was saying earlier, that for me, to be hyper-converged, you almost need to get the full package, shrink-wrapped, hardware, software, everything bundled together. You tear off the shrink-wrap, you plug in the power, you plug in the network. 2 minutes later, you're rocking and rolling with hyper-converged. Microsoft don't play in that hardware space, so they've got the software layer, potentially.
VMware doesn't play in the hardware space. They've got 8 partners doing it with them.
Right. Okay. But we're saying that's lacking in the Microsoft space, right? Yes. That partner ecosystem.
Yes. They're not doing it. They have all the building blocks. They have the storage layer if they want to. They have the hypervisor. They have a very good software-defined networking story in there. They've got all the building blocks they need, and they're not in that market. They're not in that space of I want to set and forget and buy it in a single box and buy boxes more and more and more and just do a single-click install. They don't have that play.
Think I agree.
I think the deal there is that Microsoft believes that the hardware partners should deliver that integration, and it looks like VMware has said that we're going to do that, you know, sort of on behalf of our partners and let them follow this model.
Well, the hardware integrators don't do that either. They let that do by the resellers, and every single reseller has to design it on their own. They're doing it with PowerShell. Most of the time, they're doing it manually, installing the whole System Center stack, which gives them services, of course. But that's the whole premise of hyperconverged, that those installing the infrastructure should not be the services you sell. It's after the infrastructure is there. That's where your services should go. Your services should go to business applications, not to the infrastructure time.
Right. So in that case, in that sense, then, that VMware is not doing the partners any favors.
They are. They are. If I am a customer and I want to buy a private cloud on-premises solution, right, and I've got a couple of thousands to spend on services, what do you think I want to spend it on? Infrastructure installation or my business application migrations?
Fair enough. Good argument. I buy that.
Cool. So I think that's a good answer. And I think it's also the kind of thing that we could probably take the whole show discussing and even still maybe not satisfy Jeff. But thanks, Jeff, for chiming in. Totally appreciate it. Great discussion on LinkedIn. And hopefully we'll have more discussions like this in the future. Now, something else that we did talk about briefly on last week's show, I think it's something that you mentioned again, Mark, was around trying to make money off of the back of open source products, right? Now, we talked about potentially Red Hat being the poster child there. Over the last, I don't know how many years, over the long term, right? They seem to be the only company that's really been able to make a fairly decent go of it. Now, a couple of things with regards to that. So we've got the Red Hat Enterprise Linux OpenStack Platform 6 to discuss, but also, do we want to briefly mention Hortonworks numbers?
You know, this is the trouble with an IPO, right? Because now your books are open and everybody gets to know exactly how much you're spending to get those dollars of revenue. And, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. Great, now you're public, but now also you have to deal with everybody scrutinizing your business practices and whatnot. And what they find, I think, in for a lot of open source technologies is that the money's to be made on support and services. And, you know, you really don't control the software per se. Like I said, support and services are where the bread and butter are. And if you don't have a large enough customer base to generate the revenue off top of that, and if, you know, you're not charging a whole lot for that stuff, then...
Can you, Gabe, just for the listeners, can you give that some background in what the actual news of Hortonworks was?
Sure. What it boiled down to, if I remember correctly, was that the vast majority of their revenue was coming in from the services side of what Hortonworks was doing and nothing else. Not so much nothing else, but it was kind of a, I guess, help me.
It was support and professional services. Over the last quarter, professional services was, of those two areas, was the one that was ramping a lot more than the support side of things. Now, I took that, okay, I inferred from that
it's hard to install and complex and not simple.
Yeah, because I think what Hans mentioned earlier about the Microsoft thing was that, you know, partners like to, or businesses actually, they don't mind buying something and spending money on professional services to do business application migrations and things. What they don't like is paying for professional services to glue it all together and get it installed in the first place. And it sounds like with a lot of the Hadoop stuff and with Hortonworks, sounds like they're paying professional services to come and get it up and installed for them. And that can't be good.
No, not at all. Right. They've got to have a lot of professional services to help people figure out how to get data into the Hadoop engine. It's not an installation exercise. It's a data wrangling exercise.
Oh, is that right?
So, I suspect that's true. I suspect it's some of both. I suspect it's part installation, but my guess is the bigger part is trying to figure out how to get Hadoop up and running so you can start making sense out of it, right? One of the biggest problems with the analytics business is figuring out how do we get information that's usable, that's actionable out of the stuff that we feed in. And my guess is that Hortonworks has to do a lot of coaching and provide professional services so people can actually get value out of it.
Yeah. You know what, though? Does that not beg the question that if it becomes easy for customers to do that themselves, then Hortonworks stand to lose one of their main revenue stream at the moment in professional services? Is it in their interest to make that side of things simpler? It should be for the customer, but thinking about their own bottom line, you know, if their main source of income is professional services, they need to keep driving more and more of that, right?
The hardest person to find these days is a data scientist. Right. So that's what Hortonworks is providing. They're providing data scientists to help customers do this stuff. And I think it's going to take some time before people figure out how to get this done.
Nigel, I do want to come back and it to one comment you made just 1 minute ago about that making stuff easier for customers. Yes, in every single aspect of the business, if you can make stuff easier for the customer, you should, because that helps you do more for that customer in other areas. And if you're not doing it, someone else will.
I totally agree with that, but just take Hortonworks as an example. If they make what's hard at the moment really simple, then where are they going to get that professional services revenue from?
Managed services. I mean, you can do a Hortonworks managed service deployment or a Jumpstart kit or anything else, because this isn't something that's super simple and turnkey, and you don't necessarily have the expertise in-house. I think what's happening, you'll see a parallel between what's happening with Hortonworks and some of those technologies and what's happening with OpenStack, where some companies like MetaCloud or whatnot are able to go in and kind of jumpstart a customer to get going, manage it for them for a certain period of time, and then have them transition and get the full value out of the platform.
The full value out of the platform, but then what's in it for MetaCloud after that and others, yeah?
You know what? I mean, those are not cheap platforms to deliver and get up and running. I've seen some service contracts for some of these platforms as they're delivered as a service or a managed service. It's fairly lucrative. And then of course, you become almost like a trusted advisor at one point. So if you want to continue to go down that road and you still don't think you have, experts in house, then you go back to them. I mean, look at the same way with VMware. We still get, VMware and partners still get a lot of money off of implementation and professional services around virtualization, even though I would think that the vast majority of people who've been playing with VMware for the last decade are fairly competent. You still have to go back to get some help on some of the more advanced things, and that's where you get to charge and create a continual run rate of business.
Well, I'm okay with the advanced stuff. I mean, there's always work, and especially if you look at a VMware solution, there's a million buttons to click if you really want to go through in every single possible feature or setting. And I think that's good, because there's probably at least one customer for every single button, and I hope so, because otherwise they shouldn't have spent the time to do it. So there's in advanced troubleshooting, in advanced management, it is good to have those people. They should not be there for those first 2 weeks. That's the whole point.
One thing I did find interesting, I was going back through a few things and, looking at some forecasts by some groups, and like Wikibon did something about big data forecasting, and if you look at their chart, and maybe I can make it available in the show notes, but they show where is the vast majority of money to be made in the big data market. Well, it's professional services by and large overshadowing everything else combined.
Yeah, those professional services would be in the area of the data science, the data wrangling, figuring out how to get actionable results from what goes into the system. That's the hard part.
Going back to to Red Hat, would that be the same for them? Is their biggest revenue in services and support, or is the revenue there a large amount of licensing?
I think it has to be in support. Like, you don't buy Red Hat Linux, you buy support for Red Hat Linux. Mm-hmm. And it's not cheap. So I think, you know, that's the vast majority of their income comes from that. And you may start to see it come from some other projects that they've started to work on. You know, they acquired, what, Ink Tank. So there's going to be, you know, more around storage and whatnot. So it would be interesting to see how well they do and how much traction they get in that space.
So I know
it's a support business model. I mean, that's why when people look at, you know, open source software, can you make a business out of it? They look at Red Hat and they say, well, there's an example, or maybe, you know, we talked about this last week, the only example of a big business that's open source. And a lot of people still feel that they leave a lot of money on the table, yeah, right? Because they're only getting it basically from support and maintenance.
I know a lot of Red Hat customers will actually use a lot of CentOS in their environment. Obviously, that's downstream binary compatible with Red Hat. And what they'll tend to do is they'll have a handful of official Red Hat systems in there that have got support on them, but the vast majority of stuff running on CentOS for free. And then if they come across a bug that they can't fix themselves, they recreate it on one of their supported systems, pick up the phone to Red Hat and say, hey, we've got a problem. And it's a little bit cheeky of them, but they may have like 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 servers in their estate with a couple of hundred on support and the rest of them running CentOS. Now, that's not going to help Red Hat, but that's what you deal with in the open source world, I think.
Cheeky is an interesting word for that.
Yeah. I'm not saying that I've ever done it, of course. Now, speaking of Red Hat, actually, they released Red Hat Enterprise Linux OpenStack Platform 6, which I think, right, it's got to be one of the worst product names in the world. I'm starting to think this is the year of the weird version numbers, but Red Hat Enterprise Linux OpenStack Platform version 6, but it's actually only the fourth version of it, and it's based on OpenStack Juno, which is the 10th version of OpenStack. So I don't know where they get the name and the number from. But it was interesting that in their blog article that they made, they talked about this being really aimed at accelerating adoption in enterprises, telcos, ISPs, and the public cloud, which I thought is great. You know, that's what we talk about all the time, especially in the enterprise. Where is that accelerated adoption in the enterprise going to come from? But you know what? All they talked about was increased reliability and increased stability. And I'm not knocking those. Those are really important, right? But there was zero talk of any easy button like we've talked about in previous shows. There was just no talk about how it's made easier for their customers to deploy. It was all reliability, stability, and that's good and all. But enterprises, they need that easy button. And I don't know if Red Hat are the right company to really be pushing that enterprise adoption. I love them, but I can't get excited about those guys in the OpenStack space.
Yeah, I take an alternative viewpoint. I think enterprises that have standardized on Linux as a platform of delivery already know how to easily deploy and integrate and provision those workloads. They have that stuff dialed in long before, I think, you know, most Microsoft customers did, primarily because of the structure of Linux and how easy it is to reproduce. You know, the customers I see, you know, who have focused and they're primarily Linux shops, those guys really know what they're doing. And I don't think that there's a challenge so much per se in, you know, enterprise Linux adoption in the enterprise. Even with it comes from Red Hat, it ends up for most of those customers being a cost discussion and whether they have the internal support or internal teams to go and get the CentOS version or actually pay for the supported version within from RHEL.
So what's the OpenStack part of this? You know, they have this long name. They're getting to name things like Microsoft, Windows, something, right? So they're doing kind of a similar thing. What's the OpenStack bit here?
Yes, so I guess their take on OpenStack is that it's co-engineered and tightly integrated with the likes of Red Hat Enterprise Linux, KVM, and any of the platforms that they've got. So if you're an existing customer, there's a good chance you've already got RHEL and you've already got KVM. Well, potentially it's easier to then layer their flavor of OpenStack on top of your estate, rather than if you go to, just as an example, right, and it might not be a great example, but Canonical, who are obviously going to have had a focus on their Linux distribution, Ubuntu. So I'm guessing that they're saying, well, if you're an existing Red Hat customer, you already know us and hopefully love us. Come and buy your OpenStack from us, and we'll give you what we talked about earlier, the professional services and all that kind of stuff to layer it on top. That's my take, but I don't know. Is that answering your question?
No, is there any OpenStack technology that's part of this distribution?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all based on the Juno release of OpenStack. They just happen to have called it Red Hat Enterprise Linux OpenStack Platform version 6.
Okay.
Crappy marketing, yeah?
Well, I don't know what you're going to do. I guess they probably hired somebody from Microsoft to figure out their naming. and the numbers, too, right? How do you? They started with version 4 and version 10. If you add them together and cut them in half, that would be 7. That's not 6. Do you round down from 7 to 6? Who does that? Where does this come from?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they're trying to be VMware. Everybody goes to 6.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, there's the VMware, too. Oh, my. Yeah, we go from Windows 8 to Windows 10 and VMware what to what?
Yeah, exactly.
vSAN 1 to 6.
I mean, that's what's happening. These companies, they can't count anymore.
Speaking of that, let's switch to product and tech news from the week. I'm going to just butcher our agenda slightly. Since we're talking about Linux, version 4.0, or at least the release candidate for version 4.0 of the Linux kernel, hit the streets this week. But despite the big new release number, so going from, I think, 3.19 to 4.0, there's actually nothing special about it. Now, I don't know how much you guys know about this, but basically the version numbers for the Linux kernel, Linus Torvalds just decides whatever he feels like, this is going to be the next version number. Yeah. And he doesn't like big numbers. So
He probably also doesn't like the number 420.
420, go on.
Well, it's code. It's code, 420.
Oh, is it?
You can
look
wasted
it up. On me. I'll look that up.
It's
yeah.
wasted on you. Good choice of words.
Our Colorado, California, and Washington listeners will understand.
Oh, is that right?
420 friendly. Just look up 420 friendly, Nigel.
I'll do
and,
that.
And you can even throw the word wasted into the search and you'll figure it out.
Cool. I'll definitely do that. So anyway, Linux kernel at version 4.0. It's actually, if you look at it, it's a little bit like the vSphere 6.0 because wind back to a couple of shows ago and we said, you know what, there were a lot of small announcements in vSphere 6, but nothing that was like a headline grabber. And I think it's probably the same for version 4.0 of the Linux kernel.
Whoa. vSphere 6 was a major release that had tons of upgrades in there. There were not that many new products, but it was one of the biggest releases I have seen from VMware. So that's not really a good example.
Well, you know what? Even with the Linux kernel here, there are actually a boatload of changes in there. There's just nothing that's like a massive headline grabber on its own. Maybe it's not quite the same. I mean, they've got like non-disruptive upgrades now, and they've got support for the new Z13 mainframe as well. That's got to be good, right? Yeah. But you know what? I thought this was interesting, right? And this is a bit tongue-in-cheek, okay? But 1.0 of the Linux kernel came out 20 or 21 years ago now. So in like the space of 20 years, we've gone from version 1 to version 4. And then if you look at vSAN, which I don't know what it is, right? Is it like 12 or 18 months out? And it's gone from 1 to 6.0? So they're like totally opposite there. That's
I don't practice. Think that was an actual numbering based
no,
on
No, I know
versions,
it wasn't. I know.
Right? You know, that was a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
Honestly, I mean, but if you think about it, hey, we're talking about it, so it must have some impact.
Yeah, so maybe they've always been using base 20 to do their Linux numbers.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the version numbers are like 3.5.4.15.c. Right, they're very long iterations for Linux, yeah.
They used to be in the 2.0 kernel, not in the 3.0.
Okay.
But
if you listen to what, you know, what Linus basically said is that, you know, they wanted to keep it simple. We're just going to go from 3x to 4x. Let's keep it small and easy, you know. And I think that that's something that is good instead of a 12 character long explanation for, you know, this version. Like going back to the previous point with the OpenStack, Linux, Red Hat, Super Bundle, you know, let's keep it simple. We went from 3.x to 4.x.
He was pretty, how should I say this?
Blunt?
No, no, blunt. He was like, you know what, meh, let's call it 4, right? That was, like, the letter he wrote, there were even, and he literally says there's less contributions to this upgrade than there were to the last one. So on an actual technical side, this was a fairly small release by modern standards, that is. We were talking 9K non-merge commits rather than 10 to 11, which was previously. The only thing, and that was a funny note, is that 4, so the version 4 gets the geeks closer to version 4.1.15, which was the Linux kernel used in by Skynet for the Terminator T-800.
So I'm looking at that picture right now. So the T-800 model 101 from Cyberdyne Systems was running Linux 4.1.15. There you go. How cool is that? We've got to put an image of that in the show notes, Hans.
Yeah, I got
we do. I just have to go back a little bit because somebody used the word blunt, and there it was blunt that he wasn't going to use 420.
Still wasted on me.
We're here all night. That up. Tip your waiter.
So shall we switch gears a little bit, and we'll talk about now HDS. Are these guys turning the clock back to the good old days of feeds and speeds marketing? Because they've just been making a big song and dance about 2 million IOPS from the VSP G1000. Anybody got any thoughts on that?
You got to love a dragster. You just have to love it. I appreciate the heck out of that. Let's just make this about turning the knobs, turn the amplifiers up to 11, do whatever you have to do, make a lab queen and generate tons of IOPS and publish it out there. I love it.
I mean, that's the old days, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I think 2002 called. They went with their marketing back.
Yeah.
On the positive side, though,
I can understand. You know, I mean, and here's the challenge. And I've always, I mean, and there was a point in time, I would say, probably around 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, right? I guess a span of years where I was really geeked on SPC results, and I would read through every single one of those and see what was going on. And then I got to a point where it's like, dude, we can all do a million IOPS. We can all do it at low latency. I want to talk about why you choose one platform or another, and it's not because it goes fast. It's because it provides some specific type of value that you're looking for, or it has a specific service or a specific integration point that actually works for you as a customer or solves a pain point or a problem. And just being fast doesn't do that.
But on that point, right, Gabriel, now I'm a big fan of Caminario, actually, who were the previous leaders on the SPC1 benchmark. But I will say, if you compare the Caminario K2 platform against the VSP, okay, the VSP is that traditional enterprise class. It's got all the bells and whistles, all the features and what have you, and it now wipes the floor with the Caminario from a performance perspective. So I think I get what you're saying. If there's some new upstart that maybe doesn't have all of the integrations to VMware, and it doesn't do dedupe, and it doesn't do replication and what have you, but it does awesome IOPS. Well, okay, who cares? But this is the VSP, right? It's considered in some respects legacy, but it's got all the features, and now it's got all the performance as well. So I think in some respects, all power to them, it's got a lot going from it, as in why you would choose it. And apparently it's fast.
And it's going to cost you an arm and a leg.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's a dollar an IOP. It's 36. Go read them the details. Devil's always in the details. Hey, if you need 36 terabytes of 2 million IOPS, there's your bucket right there.
Did you read the details? It sounds like you did. I mean, is this like a closet thing for you? Like, I used back in the day, I used to read these things, and now you're copying them up.
I like to go through and dig through at least the executive summary, right? And I like to look, you know, I mean, because the way that test is structured, you know, it's supposed to be your traditional 70-30 workload, yada, 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 right? You know, I mean, going back to the part with the Caminario, how old is that Caminario result? 2 years?
Oh, yeah.
3 years old? Do you think that if they wanted to come out with their new, you know, whatever version they're on today, based on processors that are readily available and all the other things, that they couldn't beat that benchmark if it was really worth the effort? In the end, I think it's not. I mean, let's look at how much market share does Hitachi have. Does it register?
More than Caminario, but if it was huge.
Such a great platform and it had all the bells and whistles, all maturity, well, why isn't it taking over the world, right? And
So I can't wait to see the IBM benchmark where they short stroke the SSDs.
Get Gabriel in his closet, short stroking stuff.
I'm just saying, you know what? I mean, there's a lot more to performance and speeds and feeds when it comes to selling a solution and actually capturing the hearts and minds of the end users and the decision makers. It's fun to look at those things, and it's neat, but, you know, I don't think it moves the needle anymore.
Yeah. It beats a lousy press release.
Beats a lousy press release, that's for sure.
Well, there was a blog post from Chris Evans on the 2 million IOPS, and he breaks it a little bit down, and he gives the example of, there was a blog post last year about vSAN, and they tweaked vSAN that they could get also 2 million IOPS out of 32 nodes. But if that was 100% read 4K from a very small workload.
And no latency mentioned either. Yeah.
So
512K workload? Come on. I mean, that's why I said you always read that stuff before you kind of take it. I mean, like I said, anybody can do a million IOPS.
Exactly.
Let's start to talk about the value within the platform. You know, sorry, Hans, to cut you off. I mean, I think Hitachi makes a great platform. I'm not even trying to knock on them. I'm just knocking on the concept of like, you know, putting out these numbers and having a big hoopla around, you know, 2 million IOPS or 3 million IOPS. At some point, it just doesn't matter.
The problem is that once you change one or two knobs, it all breaks down, right? The example that I wanted to give was that vSAN example. They managed to get 2 million IOPS out of that 100% read from a very small workload. They say 32 nodes, but actually it doesn't even cross the nodes because it's only reading from a local SSD, and it's not even going to the hybrid to the disks that are next to it. So if you break that to a 70-30 workload, it's already going down to 600,000 IOPS, which is one third.
Right? You know, I think the problem is we don't have any great benchmarks out there, but SPC1 is the best that we've got. So I'm kind of loath to knock people when they do submit to SPC1. I mean, I'd love to see EMC submit VMAX to it, but they are the perennial stayaways, aren't they?
They did 2 years ago.
A VMAX? Was that not a VNXE?
That was an 8-engine VNX.
Yeah, with 10,000 SSDs in it, and it just made a mockery of the whole thing, really. Yeah,
exactly.
And did they do it while jumping over a bunch of trucks?
Yeah, I think they did, yeah.
To their point, though, it does prove out that it's a mockery, right? Because exactly. I think anybody can design a platform that will do well on that particular test because you know what the test is. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it's up to each customer to understand their environment to kind of make the determination and say, well, great, there's a great benchmark, but, you know, how is that even relevant to my environment? And that's what customers do. They do it through proof of concepts. They do it through their own testing, et cetera, et cetera. In the end, this just becomes almost a, you know, to use a bad phrase, a masturbatory exercise.
Oh.
Well, you know what? The biggest problem
My
is?
My ears just fell off.
Sorry.
Yeah. What I think is really, well, dangerous or whatever you want to call it, is that this actually works in the market, in the fields. The only people know that this is bullshit is we in the inner circle, in the echo chamber of ranting guys on infrastructure. And once this gets in the articles, Gartner runs around with it, a CIO reads that, and it just happens and it works. It's frustrating.
I don't know. Maybe HDS is having problems with Oracle. selling into Oracle accounts because of Oracle's hardware business, and they felt like they needed to put this out because it's still beat the pants off of anything Oracle sells for hardware.
Oracle has a hardware business?
They have Mark Hurd.
No, I think there will be some niche customers, or not niche customers, but a small handful of customers where something like this is a valuable tool for your sales guys going in. But I think for the majority, I would at least hope not.
For the majority, it's true for those businesses that really crank out lots of transactions. And there's not that many of them, but they're out there and they do buy big gear. And every single sale of these is a big deal. You know, it works. It's just, you know, I agree. It kind of seems weird, but there are customers that buy this stuff for good reason.
I would hazard a guess that the people that are decision makers who, on purchasing a platform of this kind couldn't even spell SPC1. It's not going to register on. It's not going to register to them. They don't know what it is. They don't. You know. They don't care. They're going to basically say, "Is this going to move? Is this going to be a stable platform? Does it meet the requirements of my business? And you know, can I devolve risk, or you know, can I sleep at night knowing that my team or that I just cut a check for $10 million to run my tier one applications on, and I feel good about that."
You know what? I kind of disagree, because they see this graph. And that CIO gets that graphic, and he says, "I want a high-performance, all-flash, blah, blah, blah. Let's invite three vendors. Let's invite the three vendors on the right of this graph." That's the danger of this kind of graphs. The other ones that may have a solution that is very well for this customer, that may be the best solution for this customer because they don't need 2 million IOPS, and because it's never going to be 2 million IOPS anyway, they're not even going to be invited at the table.
Yeah, I think it's – I wouldn't say there are people that – I think the customers that buy HDS systems actually do know how to spell SPC very well. There's a lot of other people that might think they need to try it out without knowing, but when they see the price tag, they won't. Mm-hmm. There are customers that need the – that really need the fastest performance they can get. And they already know, but they already know who HDS is because HDS has been a transaction performance leader for over a decade anyway.
Yeah, and obviously they're going to go. They'll balance this with Gartner and understand and see that, you know, Hitachi's always been in the top right quadrant, and so it'll give them that warm fuzzy.
Yeah, when it comes to transaction performance, they're there. I mean, so for their marketing, I don't know what else. That's like you said, it's 2000 calling or 2002 calling. It is what they've always done, you know. And they are a Japanese company. And to the guys that build this system in Japan, that benchmark matters a ton. And that has everything to do with how it gets marketed around the world.
Cool. Shall we move on? Next topic. HP and their networking business, right? They just keep adding to their network portfolio. So they've got some deal now with white box switches from Acton, plus Cumulus Linux, and what they've got, all of their other network hardware portfolio. Those guys just keep giving on the network front, right? Yeah. Is this awesome for choice, or is it no clear direction for the networking business?
I think HP acknowledges that an open strategy towards combining this with either competitors or partners, however you want to call it, is the way forward. And that companies and they tend to not follow the route that for example, a Cisco or a Juniper or so follows and say, you know what, stick with us, we're the best for you. So what is the facts from this, and there's a good blog post from Greg Farrow from the Packet Pushers, who, by the way, is very kind in his blog post, which is rare for him.
I'm sorry. That's is hilarious.
Well, Greg can have it. And he's quite nice in the whole article where he puts a couple of the facts together. That it's kind of white box by HP. It's weird. It's a weird combination. But he gives it a lot of credit.
White box by HP.
Yeah.
that's amazing. Like, what the heck is that? It's HP is all about this brand, right? How can you have a white box from HP? I am so confused. I'm utterly confused by this.
either support from both Cumulus and HP, and you could put a lot of software on top of it. I mean, yeah, I'm not a networking expert, but I like when companies like HP use an open strategy.
What's going on with their networking business, though?
Do they have a networking business?
Yeah.
Don't they have Virtual Connect?
I mean, come on, dude. Let's talk about this. This is their third foray into networking, okay? Outside of some of the stuff they've – I mean, and I'm not going to knock it because I think some of the stuff that they've done within their, you know, their Flex Fabric and their converged networking technology has been very solid. And customers that I've worked with love it. But let's talk about what this marketplace and what this particular type of switch is geared towards. It's not geared towards your standard top of rack. This is geared towards the much larger, director class solid switches where you're going to orchestrate a very large network across multiple data centers. And, you know, if you're talking about software defined, that's where the value in software defined starts to come in. This isn't some work group switch sitting in a closet someplace. Yeah, they're going up against, you know, true solid network competitors in this space, and it's just not a place that they have ever played in before. I think they'll be a little bit surprised at how competitive and how difficult it is to actually penetrate into this market where there's already a ton of players.
I think you might be a couple of years back here, Gabe, because HP's been playing in the enterprise switching market for a couple of years now.
With that 3Com stuff.
Yeah, with the enterprise 3Com stuff, and they're not doing that bad.
So they do have a sales force that can sell this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Maybe it's part of the 58,000 people that are laying off.
Yeah, we'll come to that later. I've got a question around this, though.
That just hurt. I mean, that was like the needle went all the way through my arm bone.
Yeah.
Sorry. I just don't see it. I don't. I never see that class of HP switch anywhere.
I'm just going to say this. Which company is on your paycheck?
It has nothing to do with that. No, I mean, I'm telling you right now. I don't do anything with networking. But the thing is, I mean, it's just like, I don't know, poll our readers. How many of you have seen, you know, an all HP networking shop? You know?
Oh, no. That's a different question, though. I mean,
it is a bit of a different question, but I mean, you'll see it in their top of rack solution, or you'll see it inside a C8000 or a C7000 chassis. But nobody is I would say that there's not a lot of companies trusting, you know, their core networking infrastructure to HP at scale or size.
I was in a customer recently where they were showing me their 40 gig Ethernet switching from HP, and I was impressed with that. But I don't keep up with networking that much, so.
I guess I'll bottom line it and basically say that this is a very competitive space in that, you know, there are some players out there who have definitely bring a lot more value proposition to this than, you know, what I traditionally see in Open Daylight or Open Flow.
Do you think this particular, if I can call it a product, this white box approach with layering some open software on top of it, does that appeal to a particular type of customer? Because to me, it doesn't feel naturally like it fits into your classical enterprise where, you know, they've got the Cisco, Nexus, whatever thousands they are in the core of the network. This feels like it maybe applies to
service providers and telecoms.
Yeah,
and
yeah, I think so, yeah.
Web 2.0 giants?
Absolutely, yeah.
Media companies.
And I think that there are very competitive offerings in those spaces with long track records of success. And I think it'll be tough to compete. That's just my personal opinion.
And winding it back just a couple of minutes to when you said it's their third or fourth foray or whatever into the networking space. Let's be clear, though. The 3Com stuff is still around. All of the Virtual Connect and Flex Fabric stuff, that's all still going. This is in addition to, right? It's not like they've tried something, binned it, we're trying something else, binning it, and now we're trying for a third time. They are potentially expanding the portfolio here, right?
I would say that's a fair assessment. But I also think it takes them into a realm of networking that has not been in their wheelhouse.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. But let's boldly go where we've not been before, right?
Let's be real here. And, you know, HP's not taking they're not taking a big chunk out of Cisco's or Juniper's or, you know, anybody else's business with their, you know, 3Com stuff. In fact, I think if you were to poll people who really work in that space, they would probably say, yeah, that's great. Just easy to compete against.
So are they getting pinched by D-Link?
Unless the Switch has got the number 420 on it, no.
Yeah.
That's blunt.
So apparently EMC goofed with Viper and object storage and HDFS support in this last week, but then apparently they didn't goof with it. I haven't got a clue what's going on there. Does anybody want to shed some light?
Yeah, it were two articles on the Register, and I'll definitely put them in the show notes because they're quite funny to read. Somewhere on a blog on the EMC website, they said they were going to drop support for HDFS and object storage on Viper. And of course, Chris Miller runs with it, because what you end up with is unified. It's just block and file. And it was like, whoa, was this the one solution to rule them all, right, that we were promised? And you're going to drop like the two most important ones that we really need, because all your infrastructure already has unified file and block. We just need to have that extra object and HDFS on top of it as well. Apparently, there were a couple of shifts in the product already, and it was actually bad branding. They're not dropping support. It's somewhere already in a new Elastic Cloud portfolio. It's, all in all, it's a non-story, but it was quite funny to read.
Okay. So maybe does anybody have anything to say on that, by the way?
It's a non-story.
A non-story. Okay. Let's move on to something that potentially is more of a story then, although I don't think massively so, certainly not yet. But Nutanix are talking about a software-only community edition of their software being, I don't know, 2 or 3 months out.
I'm not sure there was a timing involved.
Okay, fair enough. Maybe not. But they're looking at a software-only community edition of their product, yeah? Is that a good thing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's not going to be a free-to-use for your production environment, right? So it's really a community thing. But it's going to be install it yourself. And this is a first for Nutanix. We've been waiting for that. I think we already called it out in one of the shows earlier. What is Nutanix going to do this year? They have to either bring in more A brands like an HP and others, or they have to make sure that you get the software only. They're at that point of revenue where they can afford to not having to ship a box with every single solution. Now, to do that, to do software only, you need that HCL, the hardware compatibility list, like VMware has, and with all the issues you can have with that. The easiest part to get there is give it away for free. So it's going to be a free edition, no support.
Other than community support, right?
Well, help yourselves.
Yeah.
Help each other. Oh, that's a better term than help yourself.
So it still is hyper-converged, but without the hardware and support.
It gives people access to play with it, right? And that builds familiarity, and it in turn leads to sales. It's a smart move, in my view.
Yeah, can I run it on my Xbox?
Well, you're probably going to be able to run it on any server you have with a specific combination of, like you have vSAN, right? You can install a vSAN yourself if you have that amount, one SSD and seven and up to seven disks, right? It's going to be something in that area. Let's follow it up later on. But I was just being cheeky.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, a lot of people are going to goof around with it, and that's how you get proper ideas also into product management. It's the same thing as Nexenta has always had, the 18 yes. terabytes, previously 10 terabytes community edition. That's how people play. How do you play with ZFS if you want to play with it? You use the Nexenta community edition. I mean, that's how you start playing with it in your lab. Veeam does the exact same thing for every single new feature they bring on the market. They give you a free version, run around with it for a couple of months, and with all the feedback that comes comes from the community, they go to product management. It's a great thing to do. And it gets people to play with it. And two, it helps you building a better product.
Agreed. Now, also on the software-only front, SolidFire, those guys are going to be offering a software-only version of their wares. Is that a similar line of thinking to what we've got with Nutanix?
I'm not sure it's going to be a software-only version for you to run with it. It's going to be a software version to run on commodity servers. But it's
no in reference implementations.
Yes.
No, really. I mean, it boils down to obviously, if you're talking about a storage platform like this, we're talking all flash storage, right? You're basically going to have a qualification effort based on the hardware stack that you want to bring in, right? So today, it's going to run on the SolidFire platforms, which are Dell, and then the other qualification is the Cisco C240 platform, which is Cisco. And, I would expect to see possibly other validations with, other players, but that's an effort that takes time. And, what I don't know yet is, what does the sale look like, right? Does the customers come to SolidFire and say, hey, this is the platform I want to buy, and we buy all the kit from you? Do I have to buy the hardware from Cisco or from Dell, and then I can buy your software? I'm sure those details will be released soon. It's a big jump, because no one else in the flash array arena is providing a software stack that will enable you to run an all flash scale out storage platform. And I think it's a huge deal.
I think it's a huge deal and a really interesting one. I mean, can you imagine EMC, NetApp, Pure, any of these guys saying, here's the software? I don't.
The reason is that SolidFire is started and it's still there. It's still their bread and butter in the ISP market, right? In the data centers and the service providers. That's their bread and butter. Although the numbers we've seen today from the analyst briefings is that they're already going to 50% enterprise, which is interesting as well. But their bread and butter is the bigger data centers, the service providers. Now, the bigger service providers or the bigger software as a service providers, they buy their servers by the hundreds, sometimes the thousands.
And thousands.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, I've got these 1,000 super micro boxes or Quanta coming in, and I want 100 of them to run SolidFire. That's what this is going to be about.
It's a really interesting thing. Well, a lot of these guys will build their own boxes, right? They just buy the components and build them. They're manufacturers, they're integrators themselves. I just think it's interesting that a large scale storage vendor has decided to do this. It's, as far as I know, it's unprecedented in this business. I think it's a first. And it should be very interesting to watch to see how it works out. Any of you know of anybody else that's done this, disintegrated their, their software and say, just go run it on reference architectures?
I don't think anybody else can. I think a lot of them are tied to very specific hardware sets and validation platform. I mean, it is very tough. I mean, there's all kinds of weird tolerances that you would not think of that can impact how a flash array performs consistently, right? And so it will be interesting to see how they do the deployments, what their customers look like, who would opt to buy the software stack versus the actual appliance itself. I think it will lean more towards the larger SP customers who are, definitely more attuned and more understanding of the hardware that's specific to their needs. I think a lot of the value proposition around this is going to be focused around, their pretty much ownership of the Cinder driver and Cinder platform in the OpenStack space when it comes to all flash. Compatibility, automation. There's a whole bunch of different space. A lot of interesting stuff came out of the announcement today. They're very much still what was it? Something like 50% of their business coming from VMware-based customers. Yep. So that's compelling as well. So you're seeing that, they're probably getting more traction in what we would consider the OpenStack or cloud space than anyone else in the all-flash arena market.
They are seeing, and that was a remarkable one too, is that the cloud stacks are all moving to OpenStack.
Which makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of maturity coming into the OpenStack space. And as such, I think you'll see, you know, like I said, the service integrators, the service providers, the large-scale organizations who have been working in this space, going back to Bear Release and others, really, you know, kind of honing their game and actually making a real go of it in terms of you know, what they're able to spin up and provide.
I'm going to put it out there, but I think the writing is on the wall for CloudStack personally. I think we're consolidating down to just OpenStack. In my personal opinion. Now, on this SolidFire thing, let's just reiterate, though. Right now, it's Dell PowerEdge and it's Cisco UCS servers that are qualified. That's all right now. Gabriel, you're probably not going to be able to join in on this, but having SolidFire software sit on top of a qualified Cisco UCS platform, what?
that's a scale-out, all-flash solution.
What does this do to Invicta?
I have no comment.
Yeah. No, I know you don't, but surely Mark and Hans have got some thoughts on that, because Invicta, I don't know, the market kind of thought, have they bought the right solution, the right all-flash solution here when they picked up the Invicta platform, and it's been kind of taken off the shelf for a while. If there's a great product here in SolidFire running on a qualified Cisco UCS platform, I mean, is that awkward?
Yeah. Well, Cisco has to be able to make money on it, right? So the answer to the question earlier, how does this get delivered? You know, how does the SolidFire solution get delivered? My guess is that SolidFire would want Cisco to somehow deliver this and, you know, bundle in the software. But it's not clear to me, right? For Cisco to be in any business, they need to make pretty high margin on this. Can they do it this way? So I'm not sure that Invicta is tossed out. I'm not sure what the delays are there, what's been going on, or what Cisco's thinking about storage. But I kind of doubt that this solution is an answer for them, because I don't think it'll generate the kind of margins that they need. But I might be wrong about that.
For me, this is the same kind of deal as the Nutanix Dell deal. It's about people that can only buy from Dell that want to have Nutanix. And this is going to be people that want to have SolidFire that can only buy servers from Cisco. And the writing for me is going to be on the wall for Invicta for a part here. If you have to buy from Cisco and you have the option to go either SolidFire or Invicta, someone at Cisco at a certain point is going to have the eureka moment of, oops, we bought the wrong startup.
Well, if anybody there does, it's Cisco doesn't have a lot of storage DNA, no. Right? They're, you know, so they've partnered for a lot of things in the past. They have Invicta, you know, here's another partnership. Who knows, you know, how this got started or where it got started. My guess is it started with SolidFire and somebody, you know, and who knows how it got done.
They have tons of partnerships. Most partnerships, except for the SimpliVity deal, are UCS servers with virtualization and an external storage array. This is different. This is an all-flash enterprise big scale out on their servers, which is a straight competition for Invicta, the only storage platform they have.
That's the way I see it. It's at least a kick in the teeth for Invicta. Whether it has a long-term impact, I don't know. But right now, it's a kick in the old gonads.
Yeah, well, it seems like that, I know. But, you know, look at it, it's a different deal. But think about Microsoft and how Microsoft will develop, you know, a same or similar solution and then have competitive products internally that, that you know, try to beat each other, and we'll see who the winner is. You know, think about, you know, wide area file sharing, how that happens in a Microsoft environment. I mean, this stuff happens, and it may be a kick in the teeth to Invicta, but it may not have been even intentional or recognized until after the fact.
Well, thinking back to 2 years ago when Cisco bought the product, the first thing I said to them is that because I was looking to find new places, I was like, well, you're probably going to need some storage people, because the only storage people you have today are SAN people. That, right? You don't have real storage people. And they're like, yeah, but we're not going to build a storage business. And it was always just going to be part of the end user computing business. And it's only in the last year and the last couple of quarters that they've changed to really push out the Invicta. But that was not the original idea, to make it a standalone business as such, the storage business. And I'm not even sure, and this is, you can't give me the fact on that, Gabriel, is that if it's a storage business unit as such now.
Well, there's a team within, I mean, I work for the storage services team inside Cisco, right? So, and that encompasses a lot of different products. It's not just Invicta.
Well, but it's storage services, right? But it's there's not really a storage sales business.
Well, I mean, no, there's a worldwide head of sales, and then there's a, you know, there's a business unit around storage technologies inside Cisco that has, you know, engineering and, you know, marketing groups, and there's very much a focus on storage. Because, I mean, I still look at it, if I step away and I take off my I don't work for Cisco hat, I think Cisco definitely has an approach that is more, you know, it's like they're kind of like Switzerland in many respects. They have done a lot of business with the you know, OSMs, original storage manufacturers, over the last, you know, umpteen million years. And if, you know, at this point, I don't think they've made that leap to go into full service storages technologies across the board. They've bought some strategic technologies that they think that they can weave into where their strong suits are within compute and networking. If you talk to, you know, if you talk to me as a customer, we talk about application acceleration with flash, not just general purpose storage. So it's very much a niche product right now.
And then there was always the nyan thing with EMC.
Gents, we're running a long show, so let's switch on to more business-related news now. Something pretty much, at least as far as I'm aware, hot off the press, Emulex, to be acquired by Avago Technologies, Singapore-based company, for around about $600 million US. Is that out of the blue?
Caught me completely by surprise.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we could call it out of the blue. I'm not even – I haven't been following Emulex that close. But were they even doing a good business? That's the big question, right?
Yeah, I mean, for me, they were always kind of an awkward one or a funny business. I always associated them with the Fibre Channel market and HBAs and things. I think they've been number two there for a long time. They've never really made their presence felt in the Ethernet networking space, I don't think. Yeah, what were they going to do as a company?
In the early days, they were, if I'm not mistaken, a good HP partner when HP started with that Flex stuff.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. No, I mean, a lot of that. So, I mean, I started out as an SE at Emulex and sold HBAs and, you know, conversion network adapters. And Emulex did have a very, you know, we're talking 2012, 2011. They had a very solid portfolio around 10 gig Ethernet with the differentiation around offload for, you know, TCP/IP offload, so tow, and then offloading iSCSI, FCOE support, the ability to change the CNA NICs and portions on the fly. There's some pretty cool technology in there, right?
Weren't they one of the first where you could actually carve out the 10 gig to four
yes.
channels?
Yeah, you would basically take a 10 gig adapter and turn it into four different segments, right? So you could and dial up or down the bandwidth. So if you look at what they were doing with IBM and Virtual Fabric, if you want to, you know, the IBM switches, the full IBM stack of technologies, you could actually fine-tune bandwidth on the fly through that. They also did the same thing with, you know, HP and their Flex Fabric and their LAN on motherboard, or what ended up becoming FlexLOM, a flexible LAN on motherboard technology. So, I mean, they did a lot of, you know, they always were a supplier to the OEMs, and then occasionally, you know, they would sell technology to end users or customers who wanted to buy it. But the vast majority of all of their work was done with integration with, you know, NEC, Fujitsu, HP, Dell, IBM. Their bread and butter product always was Fibre Channel. I know one of the three guys who were part of the team who built Fibre Channel, you know, and came to market. And, you know, when Emulex was kind of changing from a, you know, a printer, I mean, they made, you know, jet direct cards and stuff like that at one point. If you go look at the history of what they did, when they started to move into the Fibre Channel market and come out with Gen 1 Fibre Channel, it was a big deal for them. And that ended up becoming a very, very lucrative, profitable business. We're talking very high margins for them.
So what does it mean today with the acquisition?
You know, I think that, one, they had struggles. You know, the Elliott investor team came in there you know, saw a company that was undervalued.
Once again,
right? And Elliott is really good at identifying underperforming companies and doing what they can to get a return on their investment. And in this case, you know, they're selling it for $8 a share, which is about 25% over what the share price is today, and definitely a lot more than Elliott paid for the stock. So those guys are going to make a boatload of cash. What it does is, I think, you know, and I'm curious, you know, the company that bought them kind of has a reputation. Avago kind of has a reputation of, you know, being job killers. So I don't know what happens if, you know, or what
they're being bought by HP. Sorry.
I don't know.
No, they're product killers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know, those guys bought LSI, right, for what, $6 billion?
Yep.
You know, then they spun part of that out, and then, you know, they sold their networking portion to IBM or Intel.
Intel.
And I have no idea what they're going to do. You know, I mean, what part of this business do they want to keep and actually leverage? They have a product called Endace, which is a security platform that never really took off, I believe. You know, they have the 10 gig networking, which, you know, I don't see Avago wanting to get into that space. I'm curious, like I said, you know, the people that are probably real happy about this is probably QLogic, right? Because now it's pretty much the fiber channel market is theirs to own. And I would suspect that a lot of companies or a lot of people are rushing over to give those guys a call today to say, hey, who could we do business with? Because we don't know Avago from Adam.
So we're pronouncing this Avago, but I was thinking it was Avago, eh? Hey. Avago.
Avago.
And, you know, that's hard. I mean, I know a lot of people over there, and there are a lot of people in that company that have been there for 20-plus years that really dedicated their lives to it. And it's, you know, I don't have a good feeling about them having jobs in 6 months.
Yeah, that sucks.
Maybe promotion is hiring. You know,
that's the nature of this business, though. You know?
It is. Yeah. On that note, let's just pivot quickly. HP are wielding the axe again. There's talk of, what is it, 58,000 job losses? I mean, what is that?
Is that, I think that's over the course of more than the 41? I mean, or is it an additional 58?
No.
I think it's in conjunction.
Yes.
It's the addition to bringing it to a total of 58 for the year.
Yeah,
that's tragic.
It's a lot of people work there. I mean, there's 350,000 people at one point.
Yeah. Well, it's still a big portion, right? It's not 5,000 here or there. It's 58 in total.
The thing about it is that it really wasn't a secret that I think everybody knew that this kind of thing was going on and was coming. And it makes it hard to be there and be excited about what you're doing when you know that's going on. So in some sense, this is like, you know, cutting the festering sore out of the wound and saying, okay, they still have to go through with it.
Yep.
You know, and people are going to be wondering, is it me or how do I know and all that stuff. It'll be painful.
Well, and if it happens every 2 years, which we know from HP, it's every single time again. It's like, well, Is it this time, my time?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, too, it's like with any organization, you got a couple things going here, right? 2012, they announced they're going to be, you know, they kind of have a plan for 55,000 people over this several year period, or, you know, 20,000 or whatever it was initially. And that number has grown. You also have a company that's diverging. You know, they're going to cut in half and have two different business units. And, you know, there are people that probably have very secure jobs. You know, anybody who's working around cloud within HP, you know, maybe the storage division, some of these areas, they're going to be, you know, they're going to be investing. They'll be open headcounts. So
unless your name is Mikos.
Yeah, we didn't get to that one, did we? but I think that there are, you know, you couch it with a lot of the different or the changing dynamic of what's happening to HP today, right? Coming two different companies, streamlining and transitioning from some of maybe what we would consider their core business units into new things. And just like everybody else is changing, they're changing as well. You see the same thing happening at IBM. We don't see as much at Dell now that they're private because not as much is open to the public. But, you know, it's adapt. Adapt your business to the new way of doing things. And, you know, that's what happens when you're an organization with, you know, probably one of the higher headcounts in the Fortune 50.
Yeah. So because we're short on time, gents, I'm going to push it on. Mark, you mentioned Martin Mikos there. So looks like he's heading for the escape hatch, yeah? So he was brought in with the Eucalyptus deal, formerly of MySQL, I think, it's no surprise that he's on his way, right?
Well, you know, he was brought in with the idea, and the big companies always say this, we'll bring in these people and they'll change us and they'll bring in new DNA and we'll get their mojo from them. But it never works that way. When you go into the big company, it's like they've too many people with vested interest in the things that they've already done. And when you come in, and I'm not saying Mikos was guilty of this, but you can't change that. They're going to do what they're going to do. And they're going to continue a plan that's already set in place. And unless you just strong arm everybody into going with this new way of working or whatever. And Mikos was going to have to change his spots anyway, going from Eucalyptus and being an OpenStack hater to being an OpenStack lover. That whole thing was just kind of ridiculous, you know. So the acquisition of employees from Eucalyptus, it didn't make sense to a lot of people. There was a lot said at the time, you know, that it probably wouldn't work, and it appears that it hasn't. And, you know, Mikos wasn't, you know, he seems like he's a serial entrepreneur kind of guy. You know, for him to be in there and just kind of deal with all the politics and stuff, it's like, you know, get me out of the straitjacket. I want to breathe again.
He was not going to be the David Scott of cloud at HP.
No.
So also we've had Don Jaworski, new CEO of SwiftStack. We've got Bas Geyer jumping from Juniper to VMware. Is that a shot at Cisco? And Brian Pawlowski leaving the NetApp FlashRay team. Anybody got any comments on any of those comings and goings?
Yeah, so I want to talk about Don Jaworski for just a little bit. He's been a board member for a long time at SwiftStack. He's always been there. Been big on it. He's got a lot of talent. He's been around from the beginning. So his going on was just like bringing a friendly in to help expand the company. Last fall, they took their expansion round. They took like $16 million of funding, and the company just needs more talent to do that. And he's been close to the company, been a fan, been a supporter. The original CEO, Joe Arnold, is staying on in the president's role. And he's a technician, and he's going to continue to work with the technology. And Don is going to work on the sales end and help to promote the company. So I think it's all really good there from a SwiftStack perspective. It's not a case where like we're flushing this guy out. You know, we're making these changes. We're having these kinds of problems. They're bringing a friendly guy in a friendly way to help grow the business and expand it, you know, from the funding that they've got. And I don't know if you've looked at their tech or not. I think it's interesting, right? They're providing like, you know, array management or the kinds of things that you would expect to get from an array controller, but they're doing that for Swift. And it's interesting stuff, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it goes. But, you know, for people interested in OpenStack and how you manage it like you would a normal array, you might want to look at what SwiftStack is doing.
Yeah. I think to make that happen on the short term that they need to make that happen, it makes sense to have people, not really new people to the company, but strong people from within the company to drive it.
Yeah, so it's like a hire from within, except he wasn't really working for the company.
No, but I mean, he knew what was going on. It's not like they pulled him away from place.
He has the roadmap and everything. He knows it. Yeah, very close to the company.
And he's replacing Joe Arnold, who's a co-founder of the company, who's going to stay on as president. So really, it's all about expanding the business, isn't it? It's taken Joe Arnold, probably was wearing three or four hats before, saying, give that CEO hat now to Don and let him run with that and drive the business forward.
Yep,
because it does seem like object storage in that whole market, my personal opinion here, it hasn't quite taken off yet, but it's going to, because it seems so tightly linked to big data and all that kind of stuff that we're just in the early stages of. So, I don't know, exciting time for the business there at SwiftStack.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, they need app support. But that'll be coming. And, you know, we had an interesting Twitter discussion this week, some of us did. And, you know, it's like, is OpenStack Swift going to be it, or is it going to be something else? But I'm a Swift believer.
Cool. Do we have anything else to talk about?
Oh, yeah. So the thing about Jaworski,
Brian Pawlowski.
Yeah, Pawlowski. I mean, to me, that just seems like a normal course of doing business too. I don't think there's anything shocking there. that is a product that I think he brought to become a proof of concept, and now it's running in, and now it's going to be managed by the product group. Right. So I think it was a successful POC, and people were looking at it and they said, well, this, you know, this, it's a single controller. It's not HA. It's not even a product. But that wasn't the point. And it was Nick Triantos or whatever on in the comments on the Register article. He said, you know, this is a very specialized product that we just took to a small number of customers. And the thing that he said that was interesting is that it's not an ONTAP product. It's a different OS. Yeah. So it really is a different product and maybe a whole different product line inside NetApp that now, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the future is. But, you know, these are interesting times in the storage business. Which kind of flash to use? How do you implement it? All that stuff. Does it make sense to have Waffle with flash? And I think they said, I mean, we probably don't need this old ONTAP stuff actually to manage a flash environment. So they tried something else. And I think it was successful. I think what this is a case where they're saying it's successful. We're now going to sell it as a product line. That's the way I read it.
And that whole product is a big old, I don't think gamble's the right word, but with inside of NetApp, where everything has always been ONTAP and Waffle, to be able to drive a product through like that, that's good going.
It is, and you know, it is good going, and they could have purchased all kinds of other companies, but I think NetApp just has way too much NIH to do that. They did successfully develop their own. At least I think successfully. We'll see if it's successful in the market.
Time will tell. And on that note, gents, let's wind the show up with a secret Windows phone app.
Hello, this is Mark Farley, and you're listening to Secret Windows Phone Apps. And today, we're going to be talking about something that's very, very secret.
I love you.
Like the fake gun and insanity plea app. You never know when you might need a little extra scratch, and you're not quite sure where the next money's going to come from. If you have a Windows phone, you never know. You might be able to use it to convince somebody else that you could have some of their money. And here's how the app works. You put the Windows phone inside a pocket, like a jacket pocket, or if you have a hoodie, you put it in the hoodie pocket, and you kind of stick it out there like it's a gun, or at least a fake gun. And you shove it into somebody that's like walking in a dark alley or sidewalk. And you just like stick it out there. And you disguise your voice like this. And you say something like, give me your money. And then when they give you their money, you can go get like a cheesesteak sandwich or something and a Coke. And kind of enjoy the fact that somebody was nice enough to give you their money just for showing them your Windows phone wrapped up in a pocket. Now, the biggest problem with this app is that the person that gives you their money could call the police and get you into a lot of trouble. And you could end up in jail being charged with robbery. And that's where the second part of this app comes in, the insanity plea. Now, you might think that you could say that you just had your phone in your pocket and that it was on vibrate and that you were warming up your hands on the vibrating phone, but that doesn't explain how you got somebody else's money and could afford to eat a big cheesesteak sandwich. So you're much better off just telling the court that you have a Windows phone and that it's driving you crazy, and that somehow this Windows phone challenged you to find a cheesesteak sandwich that you paid with somebody else's money. And when they figure out that you actually have a Windows phone, they won't care if you think the phone's talking to you. They'll just think you're nuts for having a Windows phone.
Tune in again to hear another episode of Secret Windows Phone Apps.